Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Welcome back to a new year and a new presidential administration in the U.S. I'm your host, Max Patton, and this is Directly Current, the podcast covering the intersection of politics and electric vehicles in America. The transition to EVs is often framed around environmental concern, but if you listen to this show, you'll know that that's not always a selling or winning bipartisan marketing strategy. So for our first episode of the year, I'm speaking with Matthew Metz, who's working on using data and smart analysis to push local legislators in incentivizing EV-first policies. For Matthew, the environment is personally key, but he sees plenty of strategy in emphasizing the cost-saving benefits that EVs bring, in particular to gasoline super users, who he argues bear a disproportionate financial burden for their high-mileage driving, which they may do for work or out of necessity by living in rural areas. Switching from paying at the pump to substantially cheaper at-home electricity rates is a net financial win for them, regardless of their politics. Matthew is a former trial lawyer, and he's got lots of legislative experience. So later in the conversation, we're going to get deep into the emerging battle that might play out between the federal government, now headed by President Trump, and states, including even red ones like Georgia, which stand to benefit a lot from EV manufacturing and jobs. Matthew and I really get into some of the weeds of it. So please enjoy. But without further ado, I'll let him introduce himself.
I got into EVs from the concern about climate. The gasoline is roughly 20% of U.S. CO2 emissions, and I thought it was one of the areas most ripe for disruption and change, and so that's where I decided to work. So Kultura, I founded in 2014, and we became very involved in establishing the gasoline phase-out movement in the United States. So we helped get started in California, what eventually became Governor Newsom's 2035 gas car phase-out legislation. We also in Washington passed through the legislature a 2030 phase-out goal. We started out as more of a mandate, and it became a goal. And then in 2021, we pivoted more to gasoline data. So we became very involved in understanding how gasoline use was distributed among the American public, all the financial implications of that. And so we've been getting more and more involved in just understanding the economics of gasoline and electricity and how that conversion looks for people.
The thing I find super interesting is that lots of the gasoline, what we might call super users that you look at, are people who, you know, drive a lot and stand to benefit maybe the most from driving an electric vehicle. I think, like you explained, a lot of the mission in many of these states and among, you know, folks like yourself is environmental overall, but you don't really reduce aggregate emissions until you target the people who generate the most of them.
Yeah, exactly. So in general, nationwide, Republicans benefit more economically from EVs than Democrats do, just because they tend to be more rural and tend to use more fuel. That's even true, though, interestingly enough, in areas that we analyzed swing districts that in 2020 were almost 50-50 split between Biden and Trump. And we found that even in areas that were, you know, demographically very similar and had similar population densities, that people who drove more tended to be much more likely to vote Republican. So there's big opportunities there, because the more people drive, the more fuel they use, the more they're spending on gasoline. And so we're really trying to bring those facts forward now.
You mentioned Washington, California. People typically think of these as more progressive blue states. Obviously, they have their own share of super users, but you know, state by state, there's a bunch of different patchwork legislation and even, you know, in some states, what people would call more of an EV mandate or a ban on gasoline. And when someone, say, in Wyoming hears that, they might get really anxious and there might be a bit of backlash to that. Or I'm not going to say there might be. We've seen it. So in terms of a messaging perspective, like more broadly, state by state, is it dollars and cents? Like, what do you think is the argument that works for people who are more skeptical of EVs because they've been so partisanized?
Yeah, exactly. So it's the economic argument, and the more people understand the economic benefits of EVs, the more likely they are to convert. There was actually just recently a study of solar energy in New York State, and they found that the more it became economically beneficial and more people understood the economics of it, the more Republicans were likely to adopt solar. It originally became sort of, you know, it started out as sort of a liberal greedy thing, but now it's become much more bipartisan as the economic benefits of solar are becoming more clear. And so we basically went follow that path with EVs and really raise that issue. One of our concerns is debate about costs on EVs has really focused primarily on sticker prices, but we want to really like to refocus that conversation around energy savings and about saving money on cars. And so, I mean, on fuel. So that's very, very important.
Yeah. So it's a mixture of the consumable, the fuel that people use and electricity use being cheaper, but also just a lot of these vehicles overall have lower maintenance. The other variable to consider, and you know, I know your data looks at this, is the way people charge can vary a lot based off their living situation, their accessibility. You know, it's a big issue here, even where I live, you know, near Denver and a lot of the country, for people who live in cities or more dense areas to actually be able to charge. Now, maybe for the rural users, that's not as hard. I don't know. But installing chargers, if people don't have a 240 volt level 2 charger at home, let's say, they're going to be looking at maybe going to an Electrify America, a Tesla supercharger. And at that point, the prices is a lot more comparable to gas, right?
Yeah, that's true. Although it is also true that 80% of U.S. households reside in single-family homes. So the people that live in apartments and condos and stuff, you know, because the EV adoption has tended to be larger in that area, and those tend to be more EV-friendly, more democratic areas, there's been a lot of focus on that. But from a national perspective, it's actually, you know, it's 1/5 of households that are affected by that problem, you know, most affected by that problem. So I'm not to minimize it or anything, but there's still huge opportunities of people that are residing in single family homes that could shift and could realize the full gasoline savings. We've seen legislative success, you know, hopefully, I believe that we've contributed to automaker decisions to invest more in EVs, just because I think that those gas car phase outs were a very effective tool for guiding investments to EVs. So you take some credit for that. You know, how much is a really hard question to answer.
Yeah, I know you guys also contributed a comment, right, with the current iteration of the tax credit, with advocating for that being point of sale, which it is currently. And I think we've seen effects on that. I mean, there's been a lot of uptick in EV adoption. States like here in Colorado, and I'm sure in Washington, California too, have seen lots of people buying EVs. I think in many cases, it's a financial decision. In addition to people wanting the latest, greatest thing, it is just a vehicle that makes more sense in the long run. But the, you know, the there's a lot of anxiety right now over the EV tax credit and the status of several things like that in the IRA with the Trump administration. So I imagine there'll be no shortage of work for, you know, you all to do. What are the biggest areas you're looking at? Do you think the tax credit is as good as dead? Do you think it's going to be really hard to actually legislatively change that? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's in great danger. I don't think it's dead. And so I'd just say what we're doing about that is we're going to congressional offices providing information about the savings in people's district. And, you know, William Barty Carter's district, I think, which is, he's a key congressman from First District of Georgia. Potential savings of his constituents are about $650 million per year on fuel. And so we're bringing those issues forward. Where many of the people in his district drive long distances, you know, and can save $2,000-$3,000 a year if they shift. And so we're bringing that forward for them. So I think that really honing in on that economic argument, and, you know, basically what we're saying is, hey, if people can't access EVs, they're essentially locked into a more expensive fuel forever. And that's not a good place for them to be. And it's not a good place for you to be politically as someone that's advocating for more expensive fuel. So, you know, that's our hope, is that argument will start gaining traction. And we want to involve the EV associations, a lot of other people making those arguments and the economic benefits of the fuel.
Yeah, absolutely. And then this is always, you know, a contentious point is the environmental messaging. Is right now we're seeing these large wildfires that hit LA. I think there's a lot of evidence potentially that climate change is accelerating that, contributing to it, and passenger vehicle transport is a big part of it. And yet it's still in the United States, I think, pretty uniquely a polarizing topic as opposed to other countries. Lots of places in Europe, most of Asia, climate change is kind of accepted for what it is. In the U.S., it's much more of a divisive issue. So do you think for the near future, the messaging and culture, a lot of the work you'll be doing will be kind of tangential to the environment? Will it involve it more? Like, how powerful of a motivator do you think that still is? Like, are there still a lot of people who you think might switch to an electric vehicle if they were more convinced about the environmental benefits?
Yeah, honestly, that's a really hard one, because that's why I got into it. And I have a lot of passion on that issue. But I do think that in general, there's a shift away from that. And at least in messaging of the environmental groups, again, to focus more on economic benefits and you know, the jobs work that you guys are doing, that seems to be where the momentum is right now. It may come back to climate, but right now it's not there, is that people aren't feeling that's an effective message. Because, you know, basically the idea is that, well, all the Democrats are pretty much with it, so it's all about, you know, moderate Republicans and getting those people who are not right now very responsive to the climate message. So that's where the momentum is going. And so that's what we're trying to provide, is the data that can back up that message and understand exactly who is most likely to respond to the message. So we don't only look at gasoline and fuel data and cost, but we also look at a lot of the psychodynamics and other types of, you know, kind of big data that allow really precise understanding of where opportunities are.
It's interesting to see at the local level, this is maybe a lot less divisive, not just on the environment, but on, like you said, the job story, lots of the work we do here. You know, Brian Kemp, I'm sure, is very happy about Rivian plant and them just being approved for that DOE loan. I mean, that's a big deal for people who are manufacturing vehicles like Rivian in America by Americans. That's a big talking point, and it's a huge deal to the economies of the states. So as someone who understands a little bit about, you know, both local and some national politics, do you think the influence that, you know, state governors and maybe even representatives and senators have in states might be a positive effect on, you know, this new administration, which in some ways is kind of hostile to EVs? But then on the other hand, I also want to bring in the fact that Elon Musk is heavily involved and there's the Tesla angle there. So that's a lot to unpack. But do you see kind of some threads of cooperation potentially there?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of potential there. I don't think that the connection between, for example, the EV tax credit and the continuing presence of factories in Georgia or South Carolina or Michigan has really been made. I don't think that the sort of consumer benefit and the tax benefit and the plants, that people are connecting the dots. I mean, it seems like it should be obvious, but it isn't. And so, you know, it's very possible that the governors understand that and that they're making the case, but from a popular standpoint, I don't think it's there yet. And so there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah. And maybe, I don't know, I mean, devil's advocate here, maybe if the consumer tax credit goes away, then there's more eyes on the production end of things, because maybe taxpayers and maybe, hey, Trump will find out one day, well, what's this with tens of billions of dollars being spent towards battery production and EVs? You know, there's, I think, a variety of interesting influences right now, bipartisan-wise. The U.S. is pretty hostile to the idea of importing Chinese EVs whole cloth or even Chinese battery packs. And so that, I think, a lot of people in our sphere are kind of worried about, because if China's the most ahead on EVs, then maybe the U.S. is going to be several years behind when it comes to actually being competitive on these technologies. And trickle down to the consumer, you're getting just, you know, five-year-old technology instead of the very latest and greatest high-charging, high-tech Chinese EVs. So there's a whole, like, geopolitical angle, I guess, to consider too. I don't know, maybe a Trump administration is more receptive to China, and I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. I think for us in American jobs, that might be a bad thing.
Yeah, I don't, you know, the thing is that it's a lot harder to pass a new benefit or provide aid to EV plants and EV manufacturers than to preserve an existing one. And so what I'm really worried about is, let's say the tax credit goes, then all the state mandates in California and the other ACC2 states, which I think there's like 14, that already they're having great difficulty in meeting their targets. And then if the tax credit goes, it's going to become that much harder. And in fact, if there's too much non-compliance with that program, it kind of falls apart. It can't survive if people aren't even close to meeting the targets and the governors start changing the rules. And then the whole thing about the ACC2 and the waivers, that there has to be uniformity among all the states. But once there's sort of a patchwork and California says, okay, we'll let you do 50% by, 2027, and New York says, no, we'll do 20%. It can't function on that basis. So then that goes away. So then the two policy pillars that were holding up the whole EV thing start, are crumbling or gone. And then what happens? And so that also will affect Tesla a lot, because they're not going to be able to sell credits if the regime that they're selling credits on disappears.
Yeah. And just to clear that up for people who may not know, right, a big part of Tesla's business actually is selling effectively, right, clean vehicle offsets, the way emission standards are set up in states like California, to other automakers who have dirtier fleets, because Tesla only sells EVs. They have a lot of surplus, credits essentially to sell. And so the history, I think it's really fascinating if you look in the U.S. the last several decades, is that California de facto does kind of set emission standards, but that's been a alliance between them and automakers, and an understanding that, if you can't sell in one of the country's largest markets, you can't really sell anywhere. So that's seen emissions reductions, that's seen standards increase. But, Newsom and Trump, there's a lot of animus there. Things are potentially going to get really messy, and who knows what Elon will say. And then you, of course, have very big firms like Toyota lobbying towards rolling that back. So are you pretty gravely worried about that pillar, especially the California emission standards of policy, looking really shaky right now?
Yeah, I'm very worried. And plus, the other thing too is the whole legal side. There's, Trump can, last time he revoked California's waiver, he said he's going to do it again. So there's that. There's a whole bunch of legal challenges already against it. So that's a whole nother side of threat to that program. So yeah, where we're going to be in 2 years with policy support for EVs is, extremely in doubt right now. Some of the states have incentive programs, but the ability of state to fund an incentive program is just a drop in the bucket compared to what the feds can do. And, Washington, for example, my state, just had a $50 million tax EV credit program, or actually it was a subsidy incentive program. And all the money went in 2 months. And, you know, I don't know, this year we're in deficit in the state. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we're going to do it again. Similarly, in Oregon had a similar program, and all incentives were used up within a couple months. And so, you know, but the federal, and the, those were in the $5,000 range in Oregon, for example, but you know, federal credit, yeah, 7,500, and it lasts all year long. And so mm-hmm. it's just much, much higher levels of support. So, you know, we may see a little bit of that as well.
It's very much, yeah, seemingly based off state's coffers. I know Colorado has one of the best credits, or at least we used to last year. It was a $5,000 credit. It was a bit of a bone to automotive dealers and obviously a policy spur to have EV adoption. This year here, that was just lowered to $3,500. So obviously, the even, you know, well-funded states, there's going to be limits to their coffers there versus the Treasury and the DOE and DOT working together. So federal tax rate going away, it's a big deal. There's still, you know, the utility angle here. I think you see a lot of local municipalities and private utility companies pretty, you know, stoked about electric vehicles, maybe cautious in some ways, but also it means just selfishly a lot of demand for them. And then potentially in the future, you know, vehicle to grid, all of this exciting stuff with EV batteries helping them out a bit there. So do you think there might be action on the business end of things from the electric, you know, power utilities?
Yeah, very much. I think that's one of the more promising areas. You know, there may be some opportunities to get credit markets involved in supporting EVs to a greater extent. There's a lot of complications that we're trying to figure out and how to get through, but there may be some opportunities there. But also want to take this back to the gasoline savings, is that the gasoline savings are a persistent source of benefit to EV drivers, but that benefit only exists, I mean, or it's only, people can only take advantage of them if they understand it. If they don't understand the benefit, it really doesn't exist. With respect to utilities, for example, that a super user, someone who is, we call, who's in the top 10% of mm-hmm. gasoline use, let's say someone who basically uses more than 100 gallons of gasoline a month. So mm-hmm. they're a much more valuable customer for utility because they shift to electricity. They're going to use 3-4 times as much as yeah. as the average driver. So that's more than just an ordinary household. So it's relatively profitable for them to switch those people. And so we're trying to encourage utilities to identify the people who in their service territory who are in that category and to make special outreach to them and really try to make inroads in those communities so that the word of mouth spreads. And, you know, that's one of the biggest problems that we have right now with getting this message out, is that because we have pretty low penetration in more conservative rural areas, that sort of word of mouth is just barely getting going. And we need to amplify that a lot more.
Yeah. And I wonder, you know, like you said, it's the word of mouth. Lots of times this is pretty snowbally, or is a bit of a domino effect. If you find out, you know, there's a few super users, for instance, who maybe run a local business or just drive a lot for their own needs for getting to work in an F-150 Lightning, in a Silverado EV, and they need a 60 amp circuit at home, you know, that's good business for somebody just at the end of the day. So that's a big opportunity. And hey, if their friends find out about it, that by trading in their Laramie, they're going to save a lot in years to come, that can be a big deal. But like you said, the messaging there, I don't know how to connect it. I mean, if I were to talk to most people, I think in Idaho and Wyoming and lots of deep rural places, they're still very, I think, deeply, deeply skeptical about electrification for them. One of the things, though, we're seeing in the U.S. is maybe a resurgence, or at least a blip of this of interest in hybrids, both serial hybrids with the plug-in factor and even the traditional parallel hybrids like the Prius that don't need to be plugged in but are more efficient than a normal gas car. The argument that, you know, big firms like Toyota make is that if you get a lot of people to switch to that, their lobbying at least suggests that maybe that's better for the climate than making big batteries and EVs. Now, I think you and I know that's maybe not the most honest argument, but that is gaining power, and hybrids still are cheaper for lots of people to adopt and easier than a full EV. So what do you make of the plug-in hybrid story and the traditional hybrid story for both, you know, trucks and even passenger cars.
Yeah, well, especially the plug-in hybrids that we're pretty positive about because, yeah, it's like most people who have them will drive the majority of their miles on electric. But yeah, with the hybrids, yeah, I mean, it's obviously it's a mixed bag. I'm not a huge fan, but you know, they definitely have their place for certain people, as you mentioned, people in apartments and condos. And yeah, but I'd rather see them drive a 40 mile per gallon vehicle than a 25 mile per gallon vehicle. Yeah, of course. So that's good. But we can't, you know, just stop there, because even if everyone was driving hybrids, we'd still be using, you know, gasoline would still account probably for like 15% of U.S. emissions, and actually maybe a growing share as we decarbonize other sectors. And so we just just give up on decarbonizing transport. It's just too important.
Yeah, I also saw this funny thing from, of all places, I think from the Federalist Society, that talked about, they were, you know, kind of anti-emission standards, but they talked about the fact that as vehicles have gotten notably more efficient in 20 to 30 years, it's not just that people drive the same amount and yay, we have lower emissions. People actually are driving more, to your point, on super users now than they did before, because it's cheaper for them. Gas is heavily subsidized. The price of it hasn't actually gone up that much relative to inflation, and vehicles are less expensive to run from a gasoline component. So maybe there's also a worry with hybrids that people will say, great, I'm just going to drive more.
Yeah. And so, you know, we're still using roughly the same amount of gas that we were using in 2006, which was kind of almost the peak of, or I think the peak of gasoline usage, just still around like just under 140 billion gallons a year. So, I mean, you could say, yay, you know, our population's increased. And so, you know, we haven't increased it, but it's still a vast amount of carbon, you know, and it's, you know, the U.S. uses, it's more than three times more gasoline than the, our gasoline use is vastly disproportionate to the rest of the world. And, and I think it's, U.S. uses about, I think, 35% of all the gasoline in the world, even though we're 4% of the population. So even if we, you know, if we reduce that 30%, it still doesn't get us where we need to go.
Yeah. And to your point, you know, I think full battery EVs are promising, because you can tell people, you don't need to shame people into driving less or changing their lifestyle. You just need to get people driving a different power source that is fundamentally more efficient and eventually could completely be decarbonized as we change the grid. And if you get people doing that, then people can drive all they want. And it's, you know, you still have a huge benefit. And like you said earlier, this, you know, this whole episode, large, substantial financial savings, residually way lower cost of ownership. So, you know, it's very important, I think, getting that message in. I know you guys have a lot of tools on your site for people to look at their savings. Are there any in particular you recommend people try or look at, maybe send to their skeptical friends?
Yeah. And so at data.cultura.org, we have a whole suite of tools there that you can look at. So we do have the EV cost savings calculator, where you can make very precise calculations as to how much money that you'll save. You can see the cost savings index, how much people will save per mile in various states. You can see the state rankings. You can see about the super users that we've talked about and how they affect. You can see how the gasoline and electricity prices are moving over time and how that impacts cost per mile. So yeah, so we have a lot of tools and data on there. We have a map that you can see relative gasoline usage. So there's a lot of different tools that people may find interesting. And we have a lot of data beyond that. So people that are really interested in this, I encourage them to contact us, and you know, we can talk about what other data we might be able to provide.
Yeah, I think it's super impactful for people to see that visually or to see it with data. So we'll definitely link all those resources. Thank you again so much for your time. Any more closing thoughts you want to give as we, you know, release this on Inauguration Day, and we're looking at obviously a lot of unknowns? Any more thoughts, positive thoughts, negative thoughts, whatever that you have going into 2025?
Don't give up. Let's make a big fight for the tax credit along all the different lines, and don't assume that anything is too late or too far gone or anything like that. I think we can still save it, and we need to keep working on it.
Yeah, it's the meat and potatoes of the policy. I saw a lot of people, for some reason, think that when the clock struck midnight January 1st, the tax credit would go away. So making sure we have the right information knowing what you can about the lawmaking process is very helpful. So yeah, great talking to you, Matt, and amazing work that you're doing at Kultura, fighting the good fight. Keep on doing it. And thank you so much for your time.
All right. Thank you, Max.
Thanks for listening to this week's Directly Current. If you're a returning listener, we're grateful. And if you're new, well, please consider subscribing to us in your podcast app by searching our name, Directly Current, or just following the link in our show notes if your app has those. We're also going to link Kultura's data tools there as well, so you can feel free to use those, poke around, maybe send it to a family member to crunch some numbers on EV cost savings. For the future, we'll be on a bi-weekly schedule, so our next episode will be 2 weeks from now with a very exciting guest who is in elected office. In the meantime, you can see all of the work we're doing at the American EV Jobs Alliance by going to evpolitics.org, also linked in the show notes, with plenty of articles, write-ups, and opinions to come, especially around the emerging Trump administration and the legislative patchwork battleground we're going to see on advanced EV policy. So it's going to be fun. I'm looking forward to it. See you on our next episode.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.